For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Hello, everybody. Hello. We can get going. First, I want to start out with an exercise in futility. Those of you who are scattered around, if you want to move up a little bit and closer. I know in the American culture there's great resistance to responding to messages like that, but hey, you know what? Maybe the Holy Spirit would move and make you cross cultural or countercultural. And see, this is better than usual. This is a particularly responsive audience, which gives me great hope that some connections will be made here. This is good. Thank you. Much better than average. Very good. So do you all have an outline that's the one that's being passed around? So one-page outline of the area they'll be covering. And so, he is looking for people who don't have it. He'll give each of you one. For a dollar, we'll give you two. So the name of the subject is How Vineyard Trains Its Leaders. I'm on the pastoral staff of the Vineyard Church of Columbus, which is only across the Cleveland Boulevard. So we're very close in proximity here. And our vineyard, there's about 700 vineyards in the United States, a little bit less than 700 in the United States, another 700 in about 60 countries around the world. And our church across the way here is the largest, you know, vineyard. And the reason why that's significant is because I pastored my own church for 23 years in Southern California on the beach. So I'm a product of the Jesus movement, that whole milieu. And then I came into a relationship with John Wimber, the founder of the Vineyard Movement, in 1982, and began to serve that point. And my church that we planted in 1973 on the beach, we became a vineyard after engaging with John in 82 and 83. And so I pastored 23 years at that church. And then what the Lord is doing in my life is causing me to specialize more and more, which is a real headache for a pastor, some of you may know, because pastors are much better being generalists than specialists. But people kept calling me in the movement to try to write theological things. And so pretty soon, and then I got a PhD at systematic theology at Fuller, I was just being more and more a specialist. And the Lord spoke to my heart in 94 that he was going to release me from that and be more specifically engaged in training emerging leaders to pastor, plant churches, to do missions, and all this kind of stuff. So it was a matter of 2 years just kind of praying, think about where that was going to happen. And then I had known Rich Nathan, the pastor of the Columbus Vineyard, for a number of years on the national board for the Vineyard Movement. And Rich was tracking with what I was doing. And it came to a point where he says, I think you ought to come here and check out maybe doing the training thing here because I just started a school. And I came out, taught in the school, preached the services, went home and prayed about it for a couple months, and the Lord gave me the conviction that I was to move out here from sunny California on the beach to the wonderful place of Columbus, the cultural capital and sunshine capital of the world. You have 6 more days of sunshine here than Seattle. But I love the work, so I'm not bitter. Maybe a little bit. No, I'm not really bitter about it. I really love the work here, and it's a strong church. So that's what brought me out here, and that's what I'm doing. So for the last 10 years, I've been at this church across the boulevard building a 2-year school called Vineyard Leadership Institute. It's people, almost all students work full-time, and we do this 2-year school, and basically it's areas Bible, theology, ministry, and leadership, so that after 2 years, they're ready to do a variety of things. One out of every 4 church plant in the Vineyard Movement comes through VLI graduation, so we're very engaged with that. We have some missionaries that come out of the program. We have a lot of people hired on the pastoral staffs in vineyards and in other ministries that are attracted to our philosophy of ministry staffs. And then a lot of just, you know, lay leaders who want to operate at a high level. And surprisingly to some, there's a lot of lay leaders that would like to be able to function on a level similar to a pastoral level, but they're called to stay in their secular jobs and work, like most people are going to be. And so that's why I'm here, and that's what I've been doing. So I got this gracious invitation here a few months ago to do this workshop, so I'm really glad to be here, and I really appreciate the invitation. So this is kind of our approach that we do at Vineyard Columbus. One thing that's important to us is to impart our DNA, so to speak. In other words, our whole value commitments, philosophy of ministry, you know, the whole foundational aspect of people coming into leadership. In other words, what are they imparting? Not just what courses are they teaching, but more in depth, what are they imparting values-wise? So we always try to stay very in touch with our values, that subterranean aspects that kind of determines what we do and who we do it with. So our values would be based, and this involves training, it involves church life, involves everything we do, is I have them summarized down to three, because I learned that long value statements are not transferable, don't work. So, you know, there's a whole humorous history in our movement of talking about values. Our first value list had like 17 items on it, and the ninth item was simplicity, and I used to bring some, go, isn't that a laugh? You know, nobody, not they're not even a top-level leader that can repeat by memory this value. So, you know, this doesn't work. So it took us years to get it simplified, and I've been arguing with everybody from Wimber to Rich Nathan that we need to bring it down to just three at the most, you know. I was really impacted in 1985 reading an IBM prospectus for investment. An IBM prospectus said, our primary value is service, period. That's a simple value statement, and you could communicate that through several layers of an organization. So I would say that our primary values would be responsiveness, relationship, and reality. And what I mean by that, you know, it's all in the unpacking of it that it becomes significant. In responsiveness, one of our key themes has always been John 5:19 and 29 through 30, and actually throughout the Gospel of John, you have these types of statements, you know, where Jesus himself says, I don't act on my own initiative or my own authority. I only do what I see my Father doing. So you think, reading, you know, reasoning from lesser to greater, such thing, you're thinking, if Jesus, the God-man, only acted as the Father gave him initiative and didn't take his own initiative, how much more does that speak to us? So this whole thing, responsiveness to divine initiation. In other words, we can make our plans and ask God to bless it as we go out the door, or we can learn to wait and to listen and then be responsive to his leading. And so there's, you know, a bit of a mystical element there. Not everybody's equally comfortable with that, but that's very much part of our DNA, to wait and to listen and to respond. So responsiveness to divine initiation, if you want to unpack in a whole sentence or phrase, responsiveness to divine initiation is our first value. Secondly is relationships, that we treat relationships as primary, not instrumental. People feel and know if you're relating to them as an object to get to your goal, or if you're relating to them personally, no matter where it takes you. People feel that. They understand that. So that's a very essential value to us, is to treat relationships as primary, not instrumental to a further goal. In other words, you could call it the great commandment. You know, to love others as we love ourselves and all our hearts. Another way of saying it is we value the individual as well as community. And then our third value would just be reality. You know, we want every expression of ours, whether it's in our speech, whether it's in the music we use in our worship, whether it's in the architecture of a building we would build, or it's a manner in which we operate or express ourselves. We would like every expression of ours to be authentic, non-hyped, and reality-based. So in our background in Vineyard, we make a lot of this phrase that our founder, John Wimber, gave to us called naturally supernatural. That even though we're a particular type of a church that's pretty charismatically gift-based, we're very concerned how that gets expressed. You know, we do not want hype. We do not want a particular type of religiosity or inflection or anything like that. It should be done naturally. We should just be naturally expressive. It should be very natural and not seem weird. So we tell our people over and over again, just because God gives you gifts, that's not a license to be weird. Because some people think it is. And that's just not our brand. So even in the charismatic circles, you know, I would say that Centrist Vineyard, not our marginal churches, because that's a different thing, but Centrist Vineyard would really be committed to being naturally supernatural and not weird. I know some radio waves say otherwise, but actually, that's our reality. So that's our values, and we really try to get those values through. So everybody who wants to be a leader at Columbus Vineyard, for instance, has to go through a leadership 101, or a basic leadership class. And in that leadership class, we are primarily imparting this value system, and we have everything from movie clips, video clips, of some of John Wimber's original teachings, little snippets, or his testimony, to other things that we have done. And all of this collage effect is to illustrate and impart our basic value system. So our leaders are in touch with who we've been historically, as well as where we're going, how we do what we do. And, you know, even in our church, even though we have a very active, what we call healing ministry, what you'd see is we don't look anything like Pentecostal healing evangelists at all. We just do not embrace that type of model whatsoever. It's natural, it's low-key, it's relational. And we get many, many people telling us, oh, I'm not against that. I'm just against all this flamboyant stuff we see on TV. And we say, so are we. We don't like it. It makes us sick, too. We don't like it either. So, you know, this whole natural thing. So our leaders all learn to see, to feel, to experience, and we even have interactive question-answer things in groups when we have these classes. So every leader has to go through that type of a class. We really are serious about imparting our value system and our DNA in terms of what makes us who we are. When people come into the church, we have this big thing on the wall. It's a wheel, a picture of a wheel, and it has several sections in it. And what that does is gives people a snapshot or synoptic view of the types of training, classes, experiences that we want them to go through to be a well-rounded disciple of Jesus Christ. And so we have this thing called a discipleship wheel. And so it's divided into sections, and the sections are labeled. For instance, the integrated life, which means what? It means we want our Christianity not to be like grapefruit. We want it to be like chocolate milk. What do I mean? Grapefruit Christianity is where a person goes to church, goes to home group, but the rest of the week just lives like everybody else in the pagan environment. In other words, they haven't integrated their Christian confession and thinking with their complete lifestyle. And we know that in the Western countries and in America, that is a rampant problem, that people are very evangelical on Sundays and maybe one night during the week and are very pagan in every other aspect of their life. They haven't integrated how they do business, how they make deals, how they make sales, even how they relate to their families many times into their life. And so we have a whole area of series of teachings and experiences that deal with the integrated life. You know, we want you not to be like grapefruit, but like chocolate milk. It's so mixed in, you can't separate the chocolate from the milk. And then we have the evangelistic life. And again, we have a series of classes, experiences, outreaches, things we take people on to kind of disciple them into what does it really mean to not just say I'm an evangelical, but to actually be evangelistic, which in these days there's unfortunately quite a separation often. And so we're trying to disciple them to that. And then there's the holy life. What does it mean to have our lives totally separated to God? You know, what does that really mean? And what does that look like in our ethics and our morals, as well as in the passionate love for humankind, which actually touches even into areas like social justice. Next, we have the discipline life, and that, you know, deals with areas like the disciplines of the faith. You know, what role does prayer, does fasting, does all you know, simplicity, chastity, all these basic disciplines play in. The compassionate life, in other words, how do we show Christ's compassion to the disenfranchised, to the underprivileged, to think of people like this, and then the empowered life. You know, how does the Holy Spirit interact with us to empower us for service so that we serve the Lord in ways beyond what we'd be able to do if we did not have the empowerment of the Holy Spirit. So this is a model. It's a wheel. It appears in our bulletins. It appears on the wall of our church. It's integrated through our training. So people have a visual kind of, okay, you know, how am I? I mean, we even have tests that we can offer through our home groups of, you know, am I strong in these areas 1, 2, and 3, but I'm totally missing areas 5 and 6. Am I a rounded disciple? What does God want me to develop next? You know, where are my strengths and my weaknesses? And it kind of helps people assess spiritually where they are and if their discipleship is well-rounded or it's only in the areas of their preference. You know, it seems a little bit inherently contradictory, doesn't it, to say, I'm a disciple of Jesus where I prefer to be. And so it kind of gently raises the issue and presses it into them that's not what real discipleship looks like. So I'm sure when Jesus had recruited a bunch of businessmen to hang around him and he took them with him to feed the poor, that wasn't their natural instinct. That's not really what they wanted to do with their time. They would have loved Jesus to say, let's go just catch more fish and raise money for the ministry. They would have loved that. But no, you're going to go, you're going to hand out the bread, you feed them. They were real uncomfortable with that. They didn't like that. So when we have other middle-class people we hang around with, you know, part of discipleship is, you know, come with me to the homeless camps. Come with me to, you know, the rest home or like that. You know, it's not their comfort zone, but it's part of discipleship. It's part of discipleship. It's part of the compassionate life. So it helps us have well-rounded disciples. So secondly, we have classes, experiences, ministry opportunities that press these out in the lives of believers. I mean, we know that you can take people through a series of classes and they would learn more data, but their lives wouldn't be changed at all. We've learned that from Western education, haven't we? We can cram people's, you know, cerebral cortexes full of data, but the lives don't reflect it. So we not only have classes in all these areas, we let them know what types of experiences. So if we want people to really get into outreach, for instance, or the evangelistic or the outreach area, what do? Yes, we have classes in that, but we also say these are the, you know, servant evangelism or the evangelism thing. You know, we have like 20 short-term mission trips to various places throughout the world. This is how you get on this. This is how you ask your boss for 2 weeks off. This, you know, you cover everything, you know, because if we can get them out of the American bubble and engaging in a two-thirds world, you know that changes lives. Many of you have done that. You know what I'm talking about. It just changes your perspective, changes your lives. It's very helpful. So it's important to not only have classes and things, but to also have a number of designed experiences that you can take people through so a transformative dynamic goes on them. Because ultimately, it's not just information. It's transformation that people need. And so we want to have our system well-rounded enough so that we're structured so that we can offer a number of experiences along with classes that they can go through. And then practices that embody our values and priorities. Part of our training is to train them how we do the ministry can be just as important as doing the ministry at all. So, you know, what would we reflect the way Jesus would engage at this point? So no matter what we do, it's kind of like, you know, how do we do this in ways that really reflect the Great Commandment as well as the Great Commission, for instance? How do we love others like loving ourselves? And so we try to press that out, and we attach intentionally, consciously, the way we practice each one of these ministries that we're getting people into with our value system. You know, so when we do this area of home group leading, evangelism, missions, healing, no matter what we're doing, okay, how does that reflect responsiveness to divine initiation? How does that reflect relationships being primary and not instrumental or not usury-oriented? How does that reflect reality that, hey, we may be transacting with the Holy Spirit on one hand, but our feet need to be solidly on the ground, and what we do needs to be real, authentic, and genuine, and you know, not leave the planet, so to speak. So we want to make sure that everything we do in every ministry is grounded in our value system. So we have a variety of ways that we communicate to people how our value system is being manifested through all the practices of our church. We also have a thing that's really easiest for the newest people. We call the roadmap. And this is very common to what probably some of you are already doing. Different churches, you know, Rick Warren has the baseball diamond thing, and you're on first base, second base, third, but you know, so you take these classes or do these things. And so I think a lot of us have systems, something like that. And this is just our way of doing that. We just take the concept of roadmap, we take the word road, and we talk about relationships, outreach, access to God's power, and devotion. And again, we have classes and experiences that help them, you know, get to all these. And particularly, you know, a lot of new people, you know, unchurched as well as church come in. And when they come into a large church, you know, it's one thing where you have a smaller church, but, you know, they come into a church of several thousand people. And there's kind of this almost a stun-like overwhelmed because everything's developed and technology, all this kind of stuff. And so we have a little thing like a little passport, and the passport has a page of when you go to a class or stuff like that, the leader of the class kind of checks that off. And it gives a person a sense of, I'm making progress here. I'm getting traction in this church, you know. So, you know, relationship. I went to the community series that Rich, who is our pastor and our evangelism pastor, both do together. And the community series is a six-week series that teaches people the importance of being grounded in relationships in the church and why they really, it's not optional for them to be involved in house church or home group. This is an essential part of our Christian discipleship, okay? So they get this thing. And so as they're doing these six weeks, we have home group leaders coming and sitting with them and recruiting them while they're hearing kids. You know, people want to hear the pastor. They want to hear they want to see and hear the visible people. So we bring our visible people to track the crowd, and then we seed it with our home group leaders, and we train them on the importance of community life. So that way, we have a real good recruitment percentage of people into the home groups. Because as you know, a lot of people won't go to home groups from an announcement or just a few people recruiting at the back of the auditorium afterwards or the different methods. So this is the way that we kind of integrate things together for that to happen. So, you know, we not only teach on outreach, but of course, we give them all kinds of opportunities to do it. We have access for God's power. We have weekends where we, you know, show people how to wait on the Lord and ask to be filled with the Spirit and just different things. You know, we have events that would give them a context within which to get in touch with these realities. And then lastly, devotion. We have not only an overall class of how to get a devotional life going and get traction there, but also all the other follow-up classes on specific disciplines of the faith. So, and then again, if you're getting your home groups to activate this as well, then you're having something that has a real good chance to be formative in people's lives. And of course, that's really what we are up to and what we want to do. That's all what we'd consider basic discipleship. And when we move to the second part of the outline, in terms of advanced discipleship, that is in our church, my area, where I direct our school, Vineyard Leadership Institute. And this is where we're trying to prepare people for ministry on a more advanced level. So that's why I say, you know, a fourth of all the church plants in our movement come out of graduates from our school and then other ministries and pastors and such things. So the problem in churches everywhere. The problem in churches everywhere, no matter where you want to go, is you have this organization where at the top of it, you have a handful of gifted and skilled leaders. At the bottom of the organization, you have a number of people doing tasks and volunteering. But the problem is, what you have this kind of black hole in the middle, and you're thinking, where am I going to recruit more home group leaders? Where am I going to recruit lay leaders that operate on a high level? You know, where am I going to get my higher level leaders? And that's always the challenge in a church, is how to fill that middle with emerging leaders. And the answer is you need to train. That's the only way you're going to get there. So our pastor, senior pastor Rich Nathan, one time several years ago, as the church was just all of a sudden growing at a rapid rate, he was kind of complaining to the God in prayer, where am I going to get the leaders to oversee all these people? We can't just have a crowd. We have to be a disciple. And what are we going to do? And he the impression to him was very strong. You cannot reap where you haven't sown. You know, You want leaders to fall out of the celestial funnel and hit you on the head, and that's just not going to happen. You have to sow into it, right, to reap back. And so that's why he started this school and then 2 years later hired me to lead it and to expand it. And now in our school, I mean, we have like 145 students on the Columbus campus, but we also, the second year that I was here, we launched a distance program where we have now 181 churches doing what we do. And, you know, we use DVDs, internet, all kinds of stuff. But and then we also say we partner with the pastors saying, let me help you train your leaders in your church to do this, which is very attractive. And so through DVDs, through internet, and through I've written mentoring manuals so that either the church staff or skilled practitioner lay leaders, because sometimes our lay leaders can be better at some stuff than some of the staff. And that's a good news, not bad news. And so we empower them and we have them break up the students in small groups and actually take them through mentoring different quarters in how to preach, like a homiletics class, for instance, how to evangelize, actually take them out to do evangelism and then analyze what they're doing and then learn how to present their faith more and more effectively, how to do pastoral care. In other words, what are the hot button issues that every new leader gets nailed with? Okay, you know, how many of you just realize, you know, you're in the pastorate for 3 months, and what happens? Mrs. Jones has come to you, cried on your shoulder, and convinced you that she's the exception. Her husband's so bad that she needs a divorce, and she's got you agreeing with her. You know, in other words, before you know it, you're just swept up in this thing. I mean, that's standard stuff. And we can go issue after issue. These are hot button issues. So what I've done is taken 8 hot button issues and written biblical responses to those. And so what all the students go through in little groups is they'll go through learning something about the issues, and then we have practice in class where you know, they do little what we call triads. One person presents the problem, the second person responds, the third person observes, takes notes, gives them evaluation, and then you go around the triad. So we have triads, hypotheticals, role-playing, whatever. But the key in the mentoring classes is to give people experience responding and doing. So, you know, we have this, and then, so we have different types of mentoring to be able to actually handle these situations. In the forming of this, so that became so popular that we just started spreading around, and then the need was huge. So starting within the Vineyard Movement, now it's going outside the Vineyard Movement, we've got these 181 church sites in every state of the United States, and I have some in Britain now. Who this form of training has caught on because it's highly practical and it integrates theological, biblical stuff with practical hands-on. So the way we kind of formed our training, and I'll talk specifically about Vineyard Leadership Institute because that's kind of my area, is we kind of started with the end in view, which means what? It means, what do people actually experience in ministry? And let's back up and then design what kind of training we should give them. You know, for instance, when we look at the statistics, like seminaries, a number of years ago, Fuller Theological Seminary, where I got my graduate training, did research, and a friend of mine actually was doing it. That's why I know about it, because they didn't publish it. Just like none of the evangelical seminaries publish this kind of research, it's too condemning. They found out that 5 years after people graduated from the seminary and got in pastoral ministry, that they already dropped out. They couldn't deal with it. And so they found an 85% attrition after 5 years. Not a pretty picture. Okay. And then I thought, if this is what the evangelical seminaries are experiencing, what about the liberal seminaries? I have no idea. And so anyways, the attrition rate's great. Couple that with the most common thing that a seminary graduate says 6 months after pastoring their first church. The most common statement is this: I wasn't trained to do this. It's a shock to find out that the people out there in the congregation don't want to have term papers read to them. It's just an amazing thing. But I mean, that's what you've been trained to do, basically. But that's not what they want. That's not what touches their lives. That's not what transforms their lives. And so we're thinking of, you know, how do we design training so that 6 months later in pastoral ministry, a person will say, you know what, this is exactly what I was trained to do. This has not taken me by surprise, you know. So starting with the end in view, working backwards was kind of training. And so we've shaped our school to try to, And then we actually measure our results every 2 years, too, through massive surveys and stuff to say, you know, are we on target? You know, and then keep changing things to meet that target. Now, I had a series of conversations, but in the early days of the Vineyard Movement, in say, let's say about 1984, this conversation that John Wimber and C. Peter Wagner, Ed Fuller, and me, talking about education, one of the things that they said is there's the only thing wrong with seminary is this. And it would go something like this, because there's variations on this theme. It isn't said the same way every time, but it is fantastic, except usually we have the wrong teachers teaching the wrong students in the wrong place with the wrong curriculum. Other than that, it's perfect. Now what does it mean? Now, you have to realize that this is not coming from people who are actually critical of education or even critical seminary education. But there's a flaw that would really be not just seminaries, but Western education as a whole. There's a tremendous flaw. And what it is when you look at, I did adjunct teaching for Fuller for 6 years, so I've been engaged in the process as well. But the problem is most of your really tenured professors are people who maybe tried the ministry for a couple years, didn't go too well, but they did realize they were very academically gifted. So they went to, you know, the most prestigious school that they can go to, got their PhD, and then get hired by an evangelical seminary. So they're really not pastor people. They're really scholars. And I think we ought to value our scholars. I have a high value on scholars, but that's what they are. So what we've done is, those are the people teaching. Seminaries have an implicit contract with the congregations who use their services that we will train your pastors for your churches. I mean, that's the implicit contract. So that's why people send their young leaders or their emerging leaders or their midlife change leaders to seminaries, because that's the implicit contract. But what are they really getting in this contract? They're getting students, whether they're wired or not for it, learning how to be junior scholars. Of course, most people aren't wired for it. So we have a real problem there. So instead of skilled practitioners in ministry and pastoring teaching our people how to be pastors, we have scholars who are really pretty dysfunctional at pastoring teaching our students. That's what I mean by wrong. What do I mean by wrong students? What I mean by wrong students is usually, it's a little bit different in Britain, but in America, it's self-selected. How do you go to seminary? I think God wants me to go to seminary. That's your great private opinion. And I can get the loans or raise the money, and I can get somebody to write a reference who won't say something bad about me, which isn't real tough because people don't usually like to offend people I know. Okay, and if you got that, if you fill out an application and come up with the money, you're in. So it's totally self-selected. So the route that we've taken in our school is this, is pastors... You look over your congregation and you recruit who you see God's hand on and who you see people looking to and who are emerging into leadership. So our students across the United States aren't even selected by themselves. I don't even market our school to congregations throughout the country. I only market pastors. I market the pastors to select who they want to work with. And so that gets through a lot of problems because people, you know, a pastor is saying, yeah, do my school, and pastor, you mentor. Thanks a lot. I'm already too busy. Now you've crushed me, you know. And so that's not a good system, right? But when I tell the pastor, you only work with who you want to work with. You only work with who you see has potential as a leader. So when I'm asking you to spend times like Saturday morning mentoring these people, you're mentoring the people you chose you want to. I've just given you a whole lot more tools to do a good job of it. All of a sudden, okay, now that's a partnership. Okay, so wrong professors, well, we get skilled practitioners. So all of our biblical theological classes are normally taught by PhDs in our school, but they've all had successful pastorates and minister within the value system of how we minister in our movement. And so skilled practitioners do the training, and so that handles the getting the right professor. The pastors choose the students they see leadership on and have faith for. That gets you the right students. And then what's the curriculum using seminary? The curriculum is usually more aimed towards teaching you how to be a scholar Now, some of that's changing, fortunately. I see changes in seminaries right now that are positive, by the way. But it's a long trek ahead. So the curriculum, a person's going to pastor a church, okay? Great. Let me see, what do you really know to be effective as a pastor? You need to know the edgiest German critical theory. That's going to help you be successful in pastoring. I mean, you need to know about JEPD and the Pentateuch. You need to know how this is a fragmentation of a bunch of editors. We've lost track of half of them. And you need to really tear this thing apart. And when you know that, man, you're going to just heal people when you get in the pulpit. Well, yeah, it does sound kind of stupid, doesn't it? Okay. So what we try to do is give them the more biblical theological aspects of why God would reveal this to form the person the way they need to be and their ministry. And we give them ways of being aware of what critical thinking is, but we just don't spend a lot of time, we don't spend a lot of focus. And so we want them intellectually aware of what's going on in the academic environment, but all of our focus is there. So a lot of times in seminaries, sometimes you lose track, because a lot of stuff this gets driven by the faculty guy who's just excited because he just got his PhD in Germany or Britain or wherever, or a Ivy League school. So he can sign the evangelical statement of faith. He's been through a prestigious school and has this degree. Boom, he's off. He writes a syllabus. And what does the syllabus reflect? The stuff that kind of stimulated him in his graduate program. Is that going to grow the pastors that we need for our churches? Yeah, I don't think so. So these are some of the problems. Wrong teacher, wrong student, wrong curriculum, wrong place. Where are we teaching these people? Except for some of the extension programs like they have in this church, a lot of these are being taught in seminaries that are institutions built, abstracted from the local church. It's not where the action is what I'm telling you. And that's our commitment. We train people in and through the local church. So we partner with local church leaders and work in the church. And I'd say, as a model, anybody could do this. But, why ship out your training to people who don't understand your ethos, maybe not even share your exact values, are out of touch with the history of your fellowship? Why? If you're kind of studying what corporations have been doing, some of the most dynamic corporations are extremely in touch with their values, have their own story, have their own way of training, and turn you into a representative and actually a sales force for, the HP way of doing things, to the P&G way of doing things, to the Disney World way of doing things. I mean, you are an employee who's been schooled, been trained, like that. And the cutting-edge corporations almost all do that, the ones who are, most effective. And I think in churches, when we just don't have this kind of integrative thought and we're just piecemealing things out, send this person to the psychologist, send them to the seminary for training, send like that. And then we have this kind of unintegrated stuff where we don't really understand the values of who we're turning out. And I think we shoot ourselves in the foot many times. So we need to think through, in all of our systems, whatever our networks are in our systems, we need to think through who's doing the training based on the value system that we own, and what are we training people with, where are we doing the training, and do we have both the right teachers and the right students? All right? Okay. So we have, in the way that we do it through our school, we have a clear set of teaching values for our Vineyard Leadership Institute. And the first one is community. In other words, small communities of learning. The average site in our churches out there has 4 students in it. It's not a huge class. Now, Columbus, because this is the mothership, we have a huge class. We have like 145. But our average site out of 181 sites we have is 4. And I think for us, the perfect thing is anywhere between like 3 and 10. And that's where our sites usually are. Because I want people learning together in community. So even a distance student cannot do our whole program over the internet. And that's not because we couldn't make it happen that way. I've had people offering to do that for me for a lot of years. It's because I don't want the isolated individualist learner behind a monitor. I want people learning and processing together in groups. Because a lot of the stuff, we have interactive exercises with our training, and we have them praying with each other and for each other. We have a lot of Christian community stuff going on. So we make sure that our whole curriculum is totally permeated with one another activity going on. So our people learn in community. They don't learn individually. Secondly, integration. I've already mentioned this, that we integrate the hands-on with theological. And that's why I went through a little bit of length talking about the type of things we do. Our assignments, I don't really assign term papers for our students. I assign leadership projects. What does that mean? That means a few to a handful of students get together, and together they execute a ministry event under an appropriate pastor, or they design an outreach event, an evangelism event. And then when they come back, we have a format. We actually grade this thing. We track. We have databases. Everybody gets grades, all this kind of stuff. But we have them fill out a form that indicates how the event went. You know, what was it they designed to do? What was their goal? What was the results? If they spent money, they account for where they spent it. They had meetings with people, interact. They account for that. And then they go through this whole. We all have it. It's very concise. But it's an analysis of what was the strength or successes, what was the weakness or the failure, what were the external opportunities. Like here in Columbus, if you plan a fantastic evangelism event on the same weekend that Ohio State's playing Michigan State, I don't care how brilliant you conceive the outreach. Unless you're at the game reaching out, it's a bad plan. Okay, so there's external threats in the environment, right? That you can plan a good event at the wrong time and it'll flop. And then vice versa, there's opportunities. Event can be mediocre, but you place it at the right time in the right context and it's a dynamic success. So what we do is we have our students do, every quarter they do these leadership projects, and by having to fill out the report, it forces them to think strategically about the activities that they plan. And that is good hands-on leadership training. Because you want to know what? When our students graduate and they actually get in the life of the church, they actually lead or they pastor or whatever, that is what they'll be doing when they get into a church. They'll be doing stuff like that. And so that's what our assignments look like. And we have them read academics, and we do all that too. But we balance the hands-on, with the theoretical and the theological. So integrating too. And then the third teaching value is, I just say church. That means all of our training is incarnated in and through the local church. We don't do any training that's not totally incarnated in and through the local church. We serve pastors. We don't, either dominate or try to separate what we do from them. We marry all this together. If a pastor doesn't want to do my program, even in Vineyard, they don't do it. And I just accept that. And some of them watch us for a while, and then later they say, I want to do it now because I'm seeing other people are being successful. So it's always a very low-pressure type of thing, but it's all gone on because people have seen the model works, and they wanted to jump on board. And one of the more thrilling recent developments is we've got a network of what we call Renewed Anglicans in Britain. These are Anglicans who are evangelical in doctrine and open to be changed by the Holy Spirit, and they're starting to jump on to school because they're getting very upset with sending their emerging leaders to apostate teachers in the Anglican Church in Britain and having them get all messed up. And so now they're saying, hey, we can get an evangelical, open type of thing. And so we're starting to get a lot of signups with what I call Renewed Anglicans in Britain right now, which is kind of a nice new market for us, And comprehensive and systematic training. We offer them training in Bible, in theology, in ministry, and in leadership. And what I mean by that, we give them an overview from Genesis to Revelation, so they get a lot of input on biblical things, but it's very efficient. We for instance, in a one-quarter class, like in the fall, we'll go from Genesis to what we call the former prophets, which ends in 2 Kings. We follow the Hebrew canon rather than the English canon in order, but we'll do that. So one quarter study. So it's kind of an overview, but it's more detailed than a typical Old Testament survey class, but it's less detailed than a whole class just on one book. So we're kind of right in the middle there. So it's not 30,000 foot level. It's not 10,000 foot. It's like 10 or 15,000 foot level. And we kind of give them that type of thing. And we take them through the whole Bible section by section like that. Then we go through latter prophets, which is Isaiah through Malachi. Then we go through writings, which is wisdom literature like Psalms and Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, stuff like that. And then the restoration literature, Ezra, Nehemiah, second, you know, the Chronicles, stuff like that. So, and we give them a historical perspective. So we do an academic thing there with the Bible. Theology, we actually do some systematics training. In other words, once you step back from all those, you know, 10,000-foot view of all the books of the Bible, you know, what does the whole Bible say about God? What does the whole Bible say about Christ and salvation? You know, the whole, what we call the typical six or seven categories of systematics. So that gives them the kind of Bible theological. And in ministry, you know, of course, we have classes as well as practical hands-on training in specific ministries of the church. And then leadership, we just basically start with a class in the leader's self-understanding and spiritual formation. We have them do assessments like DISC tests, Myers-Briggs. And then what I'm going to add to that is some sort of a spiritual gifts test. And then tie it all together. What does all this say about you in terms of, you know, how do you think through how God's wired you, how God's put you together to serve most effectively? And then part of that class is also going through all the disciplines of the faith. You know, from intake of scripture to meditation to prayer to, you know, all the disciplines, you know, like Foster's book, 12, we go right down the line and we get that. So we bring together for a whole quarter on this of getting an accurate self-assessment integrated with spiritual formational things. And so that's how we start out. And then we do stuff on team building and we do stuff on people understanding values, priorities, practices, and planning. How you move from values to planning, clarifying your values, and then moving to how that is moves into a vision and how you plan to get there. So we have a whole class that's just on that. We also have classes on church planting. We have church, classes on church growth. All this is part of our whole system. So ministry and leadership, right. Secondly, we talked about leadership projects already. I talked about the mentoring classes with the manuals and practicing the ministries. Here's another thing is some of you, I'm sure, are doing internships where you have people, you know, give you maybe 20 hours a week, and a lot of times they're still working, so their life is pretty stretchy. But, you know, we do 10-hour internships, we do 20-hour internships, where one of our pastors will intern somebody for a year, and exceptionally, if it really will help, 2 years. This is what really helps. By integrating our training, in our case, it would be our school, Vineyard Leadership Institute, with internships, that's really a winning combination because a combination really raises up what we call metaphorically a farm team, you know, from sports. In other words, when you see that guy on TV in the pro, what you don't see below the surface is this whole intricate structure of how the recruitment and the minor leagues, bringing them up to professionals. You know, there's a whole lot of infrastructural stuff going on. And, you know, people tend to think that leaders just kind of pop up or, like I say, drop out of the celestial funnel. And that, you know, we know that's not true. There has to be pretty elaborate or series of things that goes on. So by being able to have a structured training that makes sense, which is what I'm trying to, you know, talk about, that makes sense and combine it with some sort of internship, that's a very powerful combination. And it also is a safeguard against the number one problem of internships. A lot of pastors and leaders in the church really have a heart to mentor or to have interns, but what happens with the pressure of time is the intern happens to be a gopher who can give you more time. So what does an intern do? An intern says, hey, help set this up, help do this, would you go run and do that, whatever. And so our interns begin. So a year later, the intern feels all used up, and then they feel resentful to you, and then you're bitter that they're resentful because you put all this time in them and they feel that bad. 100 people wish they would have gotten chosen like I chose you. How dare, you know? So you can see that both ways, it's not a healthy situation. So how do you intern somebody so they don't feel like they've been ripped off, but they say, wow, that was the most formative time of my life. You know, that was really a good deal. Because you're going to work them hard, and you should, but you want them leaving like something was contributed to them. They just didn't give it all. So by combining a good leadership training and structure with an internship, you not only, yes, you do work the person hard, but they come away saying, I was really fully trained. See, they feel it was worth it. Even if they had to work really hard and really sweat through the process, they walk away saying, this was a good experience because I learned an incredible amount. So my encouragement to you is, even if you don't know what to do with everything else I've been sharing, if you do have internships or you're going to develop internships, you need to think a lot about how to developmentally add to their life, not just take from them. Because you'll be producing negative PR. You'll have internships leaving your program mad at the church and mad at you. And you know what? We got enough reasons people are mad at us. We don't need extra ones. So if you have a good training system that the intern can be a part of, as well as doing all the things you're asking them to do, they'll walk away feeling very content and trained and well-rounded. So I would encourage you in that way. The last thing here is emergence and placement. It's good to think through, and we've been trying to think through this over the time. We're just getting to the place in my school, and I've been there 10 years, where we're finding out a good way to connect people with placement. Because, you know, the last thing, after you train people, you want to help place them in avenues of fruitful service, right? And that can be a key that's missing. And what we're going to do in the fall with VLI, and again, this is where technology can be helpful. We're going to use this program called Faceboard, and it's kind of an in-house community version of MySpace, you know. And what it is, all of our students and all of our graduates and all the pastors that we have a relationship with will be able to get on this network, computer network community, to interact with each other, and through that, people will be able to say, I want to minister, I've been trained, these are my gifts, I've been assessed as part of the program, I'm ready to go. And then the pastor's saying, I need a youth guy, I need an associate, I need this. And so on Faceboard, they're all going to be able to talk to each other. And so that simplifies our life, is trying to lead this thing. And the fact that we have a controlled community, in other words, not everybody can get in it, only the people we say are in it, then there's a safety net there. You know, because we're not having some weirdo come in and do something. But we have a controlled community through this. And so this is where technology is actually very helpful for us, is people can get placed. And so in the fall, we'll put that in place. So our VLI community around the United States and Britain will now be able to talk to each other in a controlled community and have their discussions, and then also recruit for positions and put themselves up for hire, so to speak. So that. So anyway, that's a lot of stuff, and even though it's 5 minutes early, I think it's fine. Any questions and answers? You know, when you have a crowd like this, everybody's all over the map. You know, some of you have been doing this a long time, and you're going, yeah, I do something like that already. Yes, I know what you're talking about. And some are going, wow, you know, I haven't thought about that. So you cover a large gamut of experience. Dennis? Huh?
What about for a ministry project? These guys that are in your school, are they like leaders of kinship groups?
Yes, the question is, are the people in my school leaders of kinship groups, or what do they do for their ministry projects? Our guideline is this. If you're not already a small group leader when you come into the school, one of the sorting out processes is you have to be leading it when you hit the second year of the school. So there's a vetting that goes on, as you could tell right there. But I keep telling them, it isn't Vineyard Research Institute, and it isn't Vineyard Study Institute, it's Vineyard Leadership Institute. What that means is you are moving towards leadership. So either by the second year, they can make it into leading a kinship group, or they kind of get sorted out of the process.
Do you call on them to like, if they're leading a kinship group, how about building your kinship group up and planting a new group?
Yeah, the question is building up their kinship and planting a new group. We don't put particular pressure from the school side on them to do that. But, of course, part of our model of small groups is raising up people and planting groups out from your groups. So I would say that comes more from the church than does the school. It's something to think about, though. We continue to change, and that could be a way of making us more effective as well. But, yeah, I think a good model of small group leading should be to identify emerging leaders, to train them, and to have them take a few of your people and start another group and keep branching out. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Did I understand you correctly that you have like 100 or so people over here, but then you have other groups in other places around the country?
Yeah, the question is, I have a large class here of 100 or so, and what about other sites and stuff? Yeah, we have, the last 2 years, we've had between 140 and 150 students right here at the Columbus campus. And between 65 and 70% of those actually come from our church because it is a very large church. But between 30 and 40% will come from the churches in the area. And those are either other vineyards that, except for one, we've planted all the vineyards around here. In the last several years, we've planted about 18 churches. And so we have churches out there, but also we have other churches that are getting to know us and beginning to trust us who are actually sending us their leaders to train. And that's a sacred trust, as far as I'm concerned. That's an amazing step of faith on their part. But we do have a few, pastors who send us their leaders to train, which, granted, is a bit unusual, but I'm very thankful for it. And so that's what makes up our class here. But we do have 181 sites. This is one of them. We have 180 other sites across the United States and Britain. And those are usually groups of between 3 and 10 students at a site that learn together in community. Good. How many hours a week? Probably about 95 to 98% of our students work full-time. So they'll do a night class. They'll do like maybe a Saturday morning mentoring session, and then they lead a home group one other night. That's what they do. And we say that your total, we like to talk to them in terms of total hours of involvement. So we're as straightforward as we can with them, saying this course will take the average person 20 hours a week. And they're saying, wow, that's a lot. Well, let's think about it for a minute. This is comprehensive. We give them usually in the neighborhood about 400 pages or a little bit more to read each quarter. So I say if we give them 5 minutes a page, and I don't know any institution that gives you that many minutes, but I'm thinking these are laymen who are not used to reading technical biblical theological material. You got to be reasonable. So we say let's give them 5 minutes a page, 400 pages, 10 weeks. That's going to take them 5 hours a week of reading. Okay, I know how many hours of class I'm asking them to go to, 3 hours on Tuesday night. They're going to do a home group 3 hours. They're going to do like that. So what we do is we include home group leading time, reading all the pages that are assigned to them, all the classes that they go to, and their leadership projects and everything. We actually calculate that out, and it comes to a total of involvement of 20 hours. Now, can people do it in 30 hours? Absolutely. They can expand it like you can anything else. The more money you make, the more money you spend. But they actually can do that, we figured out, in 20 hours a week. And when they think, wow, how am I going to open up that much time in my life? I say, okay, hold it. There's people, businessmen all across the United States that are doing MBAs on the internet, whatever. Okay, you take one four-unit class, I got 4 hours. You go to the first class, the professor says, I want you all to know that I expect for every hour in class you spend 3 to 4 hours preparing for this class and research and writing. So that wasn't a four-hour commitment you just made. You made a 16-hour commitment, didn't you? Not only that, you realize, you know what? I want to earn my MBA before I fall over dead with a heart attack in 12 years, so I'm going to take 2 classes a week. You just signed up for 32 hours of investment. So, it's like selling anything. You got to compare the options before people say, can't do that. Say, actually, 20 hours is streamlined. And we do everything to make that education as efficient as possible. It's very streamlined. So actually, it is doable. We've had over 800 graduates, so I know, and a lot of them are housewives who've been raising kids during the first 20 years of their life. So I do know that people do it and can do it. But is it a challenge? Yes. I mean, how many people just have 20 hours that they're not doing anything laying there? Nobody in modern life. If they prioritize and prepare, can they do it? Yes, they do it. They're doing it every day. They're doing even more in the secular field. So everything's, when we tell people the program, be very straightforward. You will have to set aside 20 hours. That means as you're preparing to do the course, think a whole year about this and prioritize your life so that 20 hours will actually be there. So we're very straightforward. A lot of times we have young couples and they're all excited about, they see a DVD promo or I'll do it. Oh, they're all, this is for me, And they have like two or three young kids at home and they both want to do it. No way. We're not going to orphan your kids so you can get trained in the church. One of you do. You decide together which one. So it's a stagger. One will do it first, next one we'll do it, stuff like that. So we, you know, we're trying to think about the health of the people that are involved. But yeah, that's what we do. Yes. Yeah, at home it's harder with that large amount, but we do use pastoral references and check with the pastors and all that kind of stuff like that. Everywhere else it's easier because we only communicate to the pastors. We don't market it to the congregation. So yes, the pastors handpick the people because we're just going to trust the pastors. You know, for a long time I thought about, well, you know, I need to think of an entrance exam, you know, to reduce the attrition and all this kind of stuff. And then it came to me, as we've been doing this for several years, the best entrance exam in the world is pastoral discretion. So, Dennis.
We got a system where each home church gets a certain number of seats. And so you got two seats, three seats for your home church, and they will send you their best.
That's right. So, Dennis, this is a system, a good system, too. So, excellent. I wasn't smart enough to think of it as my problem, but that's real good too. So what we're trying to say is there's some sort of vetting discretionary process so you put your best efforts into the people that God is best situated to benefit from the training, and it doesn't dilute the thing down. I really think it's the way to go. I think we should be selective. Yes. Okay, the question is, what's the highest level we expect out of somebody who graduates from the Vineyard in terms of leadership? Well, you know, one of the things that we believe is I can't create leaders. I can't really make them. What we can do is add something to leaders that God is raising up. And that ties right into the conversation we're having about how you select these people in the first place. I mean, we got somehow got to observe, you know, God's blessing. You know, some people are just stickier than other people, you know what I mean? We try to observe that, and we try to cooperate with what, that's part of doing what the Father is doing, cooperate with what God is already doing. Now, that assumes that we're getting the right people. You know what I've noticed? I've noticed that you can take somebody who's not gifted, not called, and give them the best training in the world, and it won't make them successful. You can take somebody who's gifted and called, give them mediocre training, they'll be eminently successful. Just think about that for a minute. So if we try to put good training on top of somebody who is called and gifted, guess what you're going to get? You're going to get fruit for your labor, which is what all of us in ministry want to get. So on top of that, to address your question directly, they can go to any level. We have, like I say, every year lots of our students graduating and planting churches. So we have church plants all over the country now and a few in foreign countries that come right out of, you know, Vineyard. And you're thinking, wow, that sounds strange. I mean, they need seminary, they need this, they need that, you know. If people are gifted that way, after they graduate, I tell them, you know what, you're really academically gifted. My encouragement to you is you need to get into a seminary, you need to continue training. But what I do is I tell that to the individuals I see that on, rather than telling everybody and having a lot of people fail at it, you know, it's just an inverse thing. So there is no restriction. Like I say, you know, one out of every four church plants out of our movement come out of our graduates. So it's something that happens. What we've also learned to do is develop specialized tracks in our system. So we not only have kind of vanilla VLI or Vineyard Leadership Institute, we also have a special track for missions, a special track for church planting, and then this fall we'll launch a special track for worship leading, which in Vineyard is a huge thing. And then we're going to have tracks in some of the specific areas of ministry. And what that means is their mentoring will look very different than all the rest of the students. Their mentoring will be concentrated in areas that pertain to missions, church planning, stuff like that. So that means that when somebody's graduates, they really will be ready. Because what was typical before is somebody put their 2 years in, do VLI, now I want to plant a church. Well, you know, there's a lot of other things you need to know. Like, none of our classes taught you how to have a 501(c) or how to file articles of incorporation or how to write the bylaws or how to adopt the bylaws. Nothing told you how to budget your first 2 years of your church plant, how to, you know, So how do you address all that? Well, you can make somebody wait another year or two processing all this stuff. So we found a way to create a special track so while people are going through VLI, all their mentoring prepares them for all that. And we've done something similar to missions. They have mentoring where they do cross-cultural stuff. They engage with the Somali community in Columbus, for instance, or they go to Detroit and work with Muslims for a weekend. Or they, you know, in other words, we give them, you know, this type of experience while they're in VLI, because we're trying to shorten up the runway to when they graduate and they're actually ready to do something effective. It's the sky's the limit. We're just trying to cooperate with what God's trying to do, you know. Any other questions? Yes. Have we tracked our graduates over 5 years? We will soon do that because in 2002, we did our first survey of all graduates. And we not only surveyed the graduates, we surveyed the pastors over them while they're in the program so that we have a cross-check with both going on. So our first survey was, and our second survey done recently, were actually extremely favorable. You know, one of the things that surprised me, you know, you like your surprises to be positive, not all negative. And what the positive surprise, I mean, not all of them were equally positive, by the way, but was that 28% of our graduates were on teams to plant churches, which thrilled me to no end. I was hoping it was high, but I had no idea it would be 10%, 15, 20, 28. So that's been extremely gratifying. You know, as a church planting movement, you want to see people move in that direction. So we'll continue. We'll do the survey every 2 years. And we'll see if we're getting worse, getting better, where we are. But we track a number of areas of their ministry and lives. And we, again, have them report. We have the guy who pastors them report. And so we're doing that. And actually, that was impressive enough. So one stealth organization that the requirement is to be anonymous, so I can't mention who they are, granted us $250,000 because they saw this as where things need to go. And they want to encourage us to keep doing more of the same. And it's because we could actually give them data and give them data points that were credible. So, yeah, good question. We're trying to do that well. Yeah. Yes?
If I wanted to start an institute like this in my own church, what advice would you have?
Well, I mean, you can call me up, and I'll be glad to share with you anything we do, anything, you know. And after the session come up, I have a few business cards with me. I'd be a real bad real estate agent. I don't carry a lot of good-looking ones, but I have a few. I could give you one. You can email me or call me up and ask me questions, and I can send you our literature, and you can figure out what you want to do with it. All right? Anything else? Back there. Yeah. We have established what we call a pastor's track because we realize that not everybody is in the place of life for 20 hours of work, even though if they're highly committed. So people who are pastoring, and this is to help people pastoring, we let them do it in 4 years. So their whole commitment is only like 10 hours a week rather than 20, and a lot of people can do that. With interns, you just try to work out what, you know, what they can do. So usually with interns, what we do is we turn all the assignments, the projects, and everything else, we fold that into their internship. So that gives them time to do VLI and also serve the pastor, serve the church. And so it makes them very pliable and flexible to do the things the pastor needs help doing while they're getting the training. Did I miss? I'm sorry. No, they don't ever send them anywhere. We train them right in their church, and we bring the pastor into the training setup, and we try to make it as efficient as possible. We ask the pastor, appoint a site coordinator who gathers the people, shows the DVDs, passes out the exam, corrects, you know, collects them, sends them back to, we'll do online testing, but we're not quite there yet, sends them back to Columbus. We have this huge database. We grade, we track everybody's stuff. And then we send the mentoring manuals to the pastor. Now, the pastor can do the mentoring himself, or he can do the one he wants to, and then recruit a skilled practitioner in the area to sit with the students and do the other ones. And in our movement, sometimes we have, it's really cool, in a city, we'll have maybe like three vineyards or people that are friends of vineyard doing it, and they together say, hey, my big gift is preaching. I'll do the preaching. You're really good at evangelism. Why don't you do the evangelism? And you're kind of a counselor type guy. You do the pastoral care. And then what they do is they share the load in a town. Not everybody has that kind of blessing of relationships in every city, but a lot of our groups do. And so that way, the pastor really gets to cheerlead and be a coach and just level in where he wants to. The coordinator coordinates the logistics. And so we kind of distribute the workload so nobody gets burned out or resentful, but they're all happy that it's producing something. So, and if just a church does it by themselves, you think about, you know, some pastors actually would do all three, mentoring things themselves, but a lot of times they'll bring in other people to help them. And the key is you have a small group of people, you're giving them hands-on practice, and you're coaching them. It's more like athletics than a seminary classroom. And that forms people. That develops them. So that they actually develop skills, which is what, one of the things that we're looking for. Yeah. Got two more minutes. This says five. I like that better. But just about taking care. Oh, I'm sorry. Back there. Yes. Yeah. Is it a hard time finding mentors? Really good question. You know, the mentoring really is the throttle or the inhibitor of the system in terms of you can only successfully train as many people as you can get mentors willing to mentor. And so this is why in our distance sites, we really tell the pastors we're partnering with them. In other words, we're trying to take away the basic burden of a whole educational system from them, but what we want from them is touching base with the students they recruit. And remind them of that. Recruit the people you want to spend time with. Don't recruit the people you don't want to spend time with. That's a big help right there. But we give them all the tools they need. We give them manuals, everything. And if a pastor says, hey, you know what? This one mentoring module, that's my strong point, and you know, I don't think your stuff's all that good in some places. I say, fine, use your own stuff. I'm just creating a standard so that you don't fall below that. If you can do better, great, go for it. So I trust you. You know, you're the pastor. That's great. And so I get them to buy into mentoring, and then I suggest ways like I've done today is, you know what, do you have other skilled practitioners? You can take a pastor who's a pretty good preacher, but doesn't have a lot of time. He might be a great preacher, doesn't have much time, but he's a pretty good teacher. And there's somebody in his congregation, you know, that teaches communication and speech at the local university. You know, you could kind of say, can you kind of emphasize this angle? And they'd be happy as anything. They're going, wow, I've been wondering how I can serve my church. I get to train emerging leaders for a quarter of the year, and they're happy as clams. They're laymen, but they're eminently skilled. You know what I'm saying? I started talking to the pastor about, you know, use the resources, you know. So if you have a good relationship with another church, they want to join in, that's good. If you know, if that's not the deal, is there people in your congregation that are highly skilled? What I'm looking for is a skilled practitioner to spend time with those students so they can develop skills in that area of ministry. Yeah. I'm sorry? Not yet, but we've come real close to that, particularly because we have so many students. One thing I started doing, I think it was last summer, a year ago, I started writing to students saying, if you can, get your pastors to mentor you. Because, I mean, at our church, we have 16 pastors, but the deal is, when you're dealing with 145, 150 students, believe it or not, that's not enough to stretch, okay? So because between 30 and 40% of our people come from churches in the area that aren't our church, I'm beginning to press back out saying, you get your pastors to mentor you. Because, yeah, we felt the back pressure. Yeah, we went right up to that throttle. right up there. So, but that's very perceptive on your part. That is the governing factor, is being able to mentor people. And sometimes we do a real good job. Sometimes I look at what we've done. I go, that's poor. You know, we've got to change something there. So, yeah. Yes.
When you talk about placement,
you're the last guy, by the way. He's the last guy. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Said they wanted those people back. They want to work with those people. Is that what actually happens? Or do these people then, some of the graduates are looking for places to work?
Yeah. The question is on placement. Are some of the graduates looking for places to work? Part of placement's helped by keeping people in their local church when we train them to be in what? That's part of the deal, okay? So it's not unusual. I mean, it's actually pretty typical that if the church is growing and it's doing better, it actually hires one of those students on staff. And we have a lot of those stories on that. But many times you get to a place where a person has been a good student, they've done it all, the pastor isn't in a place where they can hire them. They're definitely welcome to stay as a lay leader, but the person says, no, I really believe I'm called in the ministry, and they're not going to plant a church that year or the next year. Or, you know what I mean? It just doesn't all come together. So then you're saying, what is that person going to do? And this is where having something like the face board, kind of like our version of MySpace type thing, is really helpful, because that person can now communicate across all these churches and say, this is what my assessments tell me about how I'm wired and skilled. These are the people you can call if you want a reference on me, and I am looking for a job in a church with this type of philosophy of ministry. Okay, and now they've got, you know, all these people that can tap into that, and they can share information back and forth. And so that advance is going to help us a lot, I think. A number of our grads do go out and plant churches, yeah. Yeah. And we have a whole 7-step church planting system in the Vineyard, so that people know where they are in the system and how to get from point A to point B to C to D, like that. And in our church planning session, we explain that, so they know about that. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. You've been good. Appreciate it.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.